Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. And I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Dr. Niall Muldoon, who's the Ombudsman for Children. Niall, thanks so much for joining me today on Reboot.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Rory. Delighted to be here.
And it's great to have you back again. We've had some great conversations over the last couple of years, and I'm really looking forward to this one again. And just a reminder to our listeners that we really put an appeal to you. Please become a patron supporter of Reboot Republic. Go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack and support us in producing these podcasts. They cost. We have no advertising. It's completely independent media. We want to bring you the voices that matter and keep putting them out. So please appeal to you, become a supporter, whatever you can each month, sign up and keep us on the road. Thank you very much. Niall, in terms of you've just been reappointed as for your second term as Ombudsman for Children. Maybe you could explain very briefly what the role of the Ombudsman is and, you know, what's kind of your highlights when you look back at your first term. And then maybe what are you kind of looking forward to or what are your priorities for the next one?
Yeah, listen, I'm absolutely delighted to be reappointed. The most you can get is two terms as Ombudsman for Children. So the first 6 years seem to have flown by. My job is to promote and protect the rights of all children in Ireland. And I do it in a number of ways. One is to take complaints from people who have tried to complain through the public service and they aren't happy with the outcome. They come to us instead of going to court. And the second way is to look at legislation and policies and how to improve them for children. And the third way is to educate people about their rights, adults and children. And through those three methods, the last 6 years have been hugely important for me. I mean, legislative-wise, you've seen direct provision. Children direct provision weren't allowed to access our office until 2017. So that coming through has been a huge bonus. There's been closures in children going into adult prisons. That stopped in 2017 as well. You know, again, you think of our Ireland has been a very progressive state and you realise you've only just taking them out of adult prisons 3-4 years ago. You know, it shows the work we have to do. And personally, then, one of the things I wanted to do for the last couple of years was to make sure that we got the voices of the most marginalized children heard. So we've gone out of our way and we've done consultations with children in inpatient mental health units, adolescents, got to hear what they had, their concerns were about the system and what they think needs to change. We've consulted with children in family hubs and homelessness, found out what their sense of what needs to change and why we can improve things. And more recently, we had a consultation with children direct provision as well, looking at not just the direct provision system, but how the community of Ireland has been looking after them and how they felt welcomed or otherwise. We were hoping in 2020 to link in and consult with children from traveller and Roma background. But unfortunately, the pandemic got in the way of that. And it's of all the cohorts of children, digital online just isn't going to work to consult with them. So that's something we'll be looking to get back to as soon as we can come to normal. So, yeah, that was it. I mean, that was the 6 years. There's been a lot of really strong work done in the office. And I suppose when I had to think long and hard about whether I went forward again for another 6 years, I felt there's a lot of work still to be done. I think I now also have a great team in my office. People are really aware of what we have to do. The awareness of the office is raised. And there's so many issues to be still dealt with that I felt I would love to have a go again. And I'm just honoured that the government felt it was appropriate to reappoint me.
And so what are the big issues for you that have to be addressed?
Well, I think we'll probably talk about the impact of COVID, which probably changed everything. But for me, I think there's a real opportunity here to rethink our society in many ways, specifically around children, because I think we need to start looking at the area of child poverty in its widest sense. We need to start looking as a society. We're the fourth or fifth richest country in Europe now. We need to find a way to ensure that all of our children are taking the benefit of that. So over the next year or two, I think we need to look at how we can do that, whether that's through income or changing the way we protect people, making sure that there's no there's a floor to which levels of income can be kept, you know, so that children can know that they're safe in their house, that they will have food, they will have heating, they will be able to get themselves educated. I also think we need to look at our mental health system. We need to look at how we support communities in the wider sense, the disadvantaged communities. We spend a lot of time working. We have 800 DESH schools around the country, so they're disadvantaged, and they get extra funding, extra support to help the students. But those students then go back into disadvantaged communities, which aren't helped. So the schools are oftentimes like an oasis in the middle of a desert. So we need the whole community to rise up when they're disadvantaged, and we need to rethink about that as well. And there's also the areas of, you know, I think special needs is just, there's a lot of work to be done in regards to that. We've left our children special education needs. We've let them down so badly in so many areas. And, you know, I think that was really highlighted through the pandemic as well. And we need to work on that.
And in terms of maybe, you know, talking through a little bit, that maybe you could explain just that mental health, the area of mental health and children and adolescents, you know, what are the issues there? And obviously we know, you know, it's been referred to as the pandemic within the pandemic in terms of, you know, mental health. And we've seen, you know, issues like eating disorders amongst, you know, really young adolescents increasing, you know, issues of anxiety. And, you know, what have you come across and what do you think needs to be addressed?
Well, I think I've always recommended that there's two types of health system. One is the primary care system, which is your GP and the people you access on a general basis. And then there's the specialized, which is the child and adolescent mental health service, which is psychiatrists and psychologists together. We need to promote and improve the resources that go into the primary care. So it's starting early. It's preventing mental health. So, I mean, you go to a GP and you need help. You might want to go to a psychologist. It could still take a year to get to a psychologist. One of the things I've recommended, and I've done it to maybe, I think it's the three different education ministers now, we need to start putting therapeutic services into schools. We need all primary schools to have access to a therapist. You know, one therapist might cover three primary schools, maybe a day a week, 2 days a week, whatever it would be. So that children as young as they need to be are now, because they're going through a different type of society now, Rory, where children are now meeting bereavement, they're meeting separation, divorce, blended families, step families, addiction, all sorts of things are happening in their homes. And it's coming into the education system, it's coming to school. Why don't we use that as an opportunity to prevent? So, I mean, if your family is separating, 6 months discussion with a therapist at 8 years of age could sort you out. But if you leave it to your 12, 13, 14, it could cause all sorts of issues and, you know, it'd be a much longer recovery period. So it's that early intervention is something I think is really important. We also need to increase the availability of therapy services to GPs. So if you go to a GP, they should be able to refer you within maybe, I don't know, 72 hours or a week to someone who can engage with you. We have a system called it's a national through the National Counseling Service that engages with GPs for adults who have been affected by sexual abuse. And the whole idea is that within an hour of drive of anywhere, you should be able to access that for free. And that was set up as a result of Bertie Ahern's apology back in 1999 to children who suffered abuse. But ironically, you can't get the same service if you're under 18. It's not free. It's not accessible. It's not that open to you. So you can be abused as a child, but you have to wait to 18 to get the free, accessible, easy to get to service. So that's something that we need to look at as well. And again, that will make a huge difference in people's mental health. If you've suffered abuse, we need to be able to facilitate you therapeutically as quickly as possible. And then on the CAM side of things, you know, we know for years that there hasn't been enough staffing in that. We've also had difficulty in recruiting consultant psychiatrists. And my understanding is that we will never be able to recruit enough consultant psychiatrists. But yet the legislation says it has to be a psychiatrist who leads the teams. And I've questioned that. You know, there's nothing about psychiatrists. It's just if you can't fill the spaces, can we not recruit anybody else to run teams and to be the head of the team. And then you might use a psychiatrist to cover two teams, perhaps. So there's system issues within recruitment services. We know from engaging with Oireachtas committees on mental health, there's 18 different steps to recruit somebody into the HSE. Ludicrous ways of doing things. You know, you're on a panel and you could be called on a Friday afternoon to say you've been appointed to a panel in West Kerry. Are you going to take it or not? And if you don't take it, you're put to the bottom of the list. That's not the best way to facilitate promotion of mental health for anybody. So there's lots of areas around there that, and yeah, as you said, the pandemic is increasing the visibility of people's mental health and the deterioration as well.
And I know there's an issue as well around, you know, for example, you know, still, you know, children having to present at A&E in terms of mental health crisis situations.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, I can see no reason why we can't staff the A&E with the right professionals. I mean, it shouldn't be beyond us. And I think one of the things that might come out of this pandemic is the more openness to online consultations. You know, we've had children 16 years of age going to a children's hospital and we're told you can't be seen here. You have to go to an adult hospital. You go to the adult hospital and they say, we haven't got a child psychiatrist to look after you. And the child could be suicidal. That's the reason they've been brought in. You know, it really is the opposite to what children need. And we need to look at that and be honest with ourselves and say, listen, this is where the gaps are and we need to fill them. And it could be the case that you have a psychiatrist in Dublin who sits on a video monitor and talks to the child in Monaghan or Cavan General Hospital. But it has to be available to them 24/7 because mental health really goes through the roof after Friday at 5 o'clock and through the weekends, and alcohol and all those sorts of things come to the fore. And children report and they're told they have nowhere to go. They might be kept in a bed for 48 hours after being suicidal. And, you know, what does that do to their head? What does it say to them about who's worthy of care? It just reinforces them. If you've tried to commit suicide or you're thinking about committing suicide because you don't feel worthy of love or care or safe, and you're treated like that when you come in looking for that help, it really is an indictment of us as a society.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And I think it's something, you know, that it's deeply disturbing, I think. And of course, you know, we can see it's legacies of, you know, how we've treated children throughout our history, you know, as a state, and neglected and deprioritized children. And to me, mental health is just, it seems like it's at the heart of everything. And that, you know, there's different sides to it, of course. There's the services that respond and that need to be adequately resourced. But then there's also the prevention. And I think in many ways that prevention and you know, therapy is part of that. But there's still, I think, a wider problem that our education system and our society is still not about, you know, minding us, developing us, protecting us, nurturing us as, you know, individuals. It's all about creating the, you know, the educated child who will go into their university spot and, you know, not, you know, and if you've trauma or if you're, you know, been abused or if you're in poverty, you know, we don't really, you know, try and nurture you, support you with whatever is needed to get you through. You know, it's all stopgap. It's, you know, limited services. It's, you know, if you have money, you can access therapy. If you don't, it's not there. We really don't have a holistic approach, do we, to that mental health and its root causes and the responses needed, do we?
We don't. And I think you're right. There's so many elements to it that we need to start doing better. I mean, I think education has really come to the fore in regards to what is the purpose of it. I think the pandemic has sort of highlighted that question for all of us. What's the purpose of education? And for me, there's two articles in the UNCRC, the Convention on the Rights of the Child. I think it's I might be sure on the numbers, but I think it's Article 28 talks about the right to the best possible education. But Article 29 says that education should be about the development of the whole person, their moral, spiritual, and potential. I think we miss out on that in our education system. We spend so much time focusing on the end product of getting into university, and we forget. And I constantly remind people that we forget that, you know, 600 points is your top of the line, but 70% of all our children get 400 points or less. You know, that's the average. So most of our students are bright, well, do well, and that's the population. But we focus on the sort of 10% who get in the top between 500 and 600, and we focus on how do we create an education system around that, as opposed to an education system that promotes the whole of the person, the people who are, you know, who are mechanical, the people who are landscape gardeners, the people who are going to turn out to be hairdressers, the people who are, you know, focus on art, construction. There's so many elements to a person, and the children that we know are all being asked to go down the route that's very narrow towards academic points, and anything else is just sort of a byproduct. So we really aren't promoting them to be self-sufficient, to have confidence in themselves, to increase their self-esteem, because your self-esteem will be increased if you're fitting into the box of you're doing well in academics. But if all those other areas are part of you as well, you know, even it's only 2 years since we started to promote PE as a leaving cert subject. So again, there's been people who are sporty who can now get some sort of self-esteem from and academic recognition for that. So it's starting to see. One of the groups I'm part of for the last couple of years, and I've been very proud of it, is called Wellbeing for Teachers and Learners. And it's our office, the Irish Primary Principals Network, the National Association of Principals and Deputy Principals in second level, the Teaching Council, and the National Parents Council Primary. And between us, we're trying to promote this idea of a well-being culture in school, so that everyone from the school caretaker through to the janitor, through to SNAs, parents, school students and teachers feel a culture of well-being in the school. And that promotes all sorts of opportunities for a child, and it reduces the mental health issues that we will come across, because everybody feels trusted, everybody feels empowered, everybody feels heard. And that's the sort of culture we need to create within education and indeed within the communities. And I think we can start to move in that direction. We're using the terms well-being. We've created 400 hours in Junior Cert to use the term well-being, but it has to be more than just a talking shop. It has to be a lived culture. And I hope we will start to see that over the next 5 to 10 years.
In one of the big issues, obviously, in the society in Ireland is faced, and we've talked about, Niall, is homelessness and housing insecurity. And, you know, the thousands, indeed tens of thousands of children who've been made homeless, who are still in homelessness, or are living, you know, in overcrowded situations with family members, or living in the private rental sector, going to be evicted, their families in fear of eviction. We have, you know, the situation of, you know, it's incredible, really. I looked at the figures there. I calculated approximately a third, 1 in 3 of our primary school children, between 1 in 4 and 1 in 3 of children going to primary school live in the private rental sector, which is insecure. Their families are, you know, potentially moving every 2 or 3 years. You know, if homeless children been moved from, you know, B&B to hostel, you know, the traumatic impact of that on children, we know it. It's an adverse childhood experience. Yet still we see policy not responding adequately. Well, what's your sense of why are we still not, like, why is government so slow to really just go, you know, this is not acceptable. How are we doing this to our children?
It really is heartbreaking for me to see that consistently. And I mean, that's a figure I hadn't seen before or heard before, Rory, but again, the concept is, and the arguments I keep hearing is that it's to do with the impact and the importance of the developer fundings, the engagement with political parties, the lobbying that are done by the higher level people who make the profit out of land and out of buildings. And for me, you know, the whole of Europe has done this. The whole of Europe has built a community and a housing system that allows people to have choices. You can live rent all your life and be secure within that rented and not be afraid of being evicted, as long as you do everything right. You can buy at an affordable level. You can by apartments where you will have sufficient resources, playgrounds, schools, creches to live a family life for one or two bedroom apartments. All over Europe, we've managed to do that. We put caps on certain levels of rent in certain areas, and people still make a profit. And I can't understand why we won't move in that direction to protect all of our citizens. Because again, you know, rental is a choice. If people felt safe and secure in renting and knew they weren't going to be evicted, then I'm sure many people would do that, because it would allow them to live in different places. You know, they may never be able to afford a certain area, but they could be able to rent there if the system and the legislation allowed them to. And I think that's part of the reason we've been pushing over the last number of years for the right to housing, because I think most of the time the argument is the right to private property is a constitutionally protected system, and that allows us to do the government, or bars the government from doing very much. And that's, you know, so if we get the right to housing and to balance that out, then we now have an opportunity to change all of our legislation around housing and secure homes and rental. And that's what we need to push towards, because it's just, it's not right. And we've seen it. I mean, when the pandemic hit, the government showed flexibility. They were able to do things they said couldn't be done, you know, and to back away from them now. And as you say, you know, the protections that were put in around non-evictions, what is the rationale for lifting those now? You know, there's no huge difference. Okay, this safety of the change in the way the pandemic is coming, the vaccines are coming. But the rationale for protecting people from eviction is security of tenure. It's children's rights. It's the safety and well-being of those children and our citizens, the older the people as well. So I think we need to move in that direction. And I think the government need to start seeing things differently. It will pay off in the long run. I mean, the argument that I always make is that if you currently have 8,000 people in homelessness, maybe a bit more, as the last time I looked at the records, and 2,500 of them are children. If all of them were lifted out of homelessness, you'd be getting tax returns, you'd be getting children who aren't in need of therapeutic service, you get children who are happy in their education, they will go on to be productive and positive in their engagement with community. And everybody would turn things around. So it just, to me, there is no excuses left for not producing a system like that, that offers all sorts of range of housing options for people who need them. And we need to invest now. This is the time to do it. It's the cheapest level of money. We still have land. I've heard you said before that, you know, NAMA still has a sufficient level of land available to it. You know, that was a huge mistake. The first couple of years of NAMA, I understood you had to sell things off. But in the last couple of years, we knew we were reaching a homeless crisis, and we were still sending off 10,000 units in a year to other people who are going to make a profit out of that, instead of us holding them for an extra 5 years and acting as landlords to allow that sort of homeless emergency to pass while we caught up with the supply. So I think there are options there that people need to think about, and it can't just be profit-led.
And we had the UN Rapporteur for Adequate Housing writing to the government back in 2019 about breaches of the right to housing in terms of the unaffordable, lack of affordability, issues of evictions, homelessness. In your view, is the Irish government in breach of the rights of the child in regard to homelessness and housing insecurity in Ireland?
I would think it has to be considered that way. You know, children's rights to a safe, secure family life is built around the basic shelter. You know, you go to the Maslow's hierarchy of need, you can't do anything in your life until you have a basic secure shelter. And as you say, even if you're not homeless on the formal sense, if you're living with your grandparents, if you're a child living with your grandparents and there's tension between the families and you're sleeping perhaps on a pull-out couch, that's not a safe, secure setting. And that sets into your bones and into your psyche who you are. It underestimates or undermines you as an individual. As a child, you don't feel safe, and that makes you anxious, which in turn leads to stress and changes the way you live your life. So yeah, I mean, I think we need to look at it from that point of view and find another way, because it's not impossible. And again, I'm old enough to remember, and thankfully for it, I lived in a small community in Donegal where guards could buy a house on their own, didn't need second income. You know, teachers could buy a house. We need to be back to that situation because our communities are losing out because of that, because people are you know, not able to safely live in affordable levels. We now need double incomes, not just double incomes, but we need double incomes that are at a high level. That should never be the plan. I can't see how any government thought that was the way forward. You know, it was good enough for every generation up to the 1990s to keep building social housing and affordable housing. I don't understand the rationale to stick with this failed policy of allowing the private sector to fill the gap. It's not working, and it's causing huge trauma for a generation of children.
And you're a psychologist, you know, from background. In terms of that idea of trauma, and you talked a little bit about it there, how does that insecurity, that unsafe housing situations, you know, and you also did a really important report on children in family hubs, which of course the government has portrayed as an improvement on hotels. But how is that trauma, how does it affect children? How does it affect their development, their life, their quality of life?
Yeah, well, I mean, let's say, I mean, children, it's difficult to raise a child at the best of times. But if you're a happily married couple who don't have a home, you're living with one set of parents, you might be sharing a bedroom, husband, wife, and maybe two children in a set of bunk beds. The tension is there all the time. You know, every time you wake up, the parents are probably disappointed with themselves. They're angry that they haven't got this. They're trying to do things the best they can. The grandparents with the best will in the world could be angry over, you know, this was their free time they were trying to do. So the tension is in the house from the very start. Every time you wake up, there's a reminder that you're not where you want to be. And children pick up on that. You know, children are looking for extra stuff. They can't do it. They can't bring their friends home. And children, the whole essence of children is they understand the world through themselves. They're selfish, they're self-centered, which means that anything going wrong in their world is their fault. That's the way they see it. So they're now going to home, they're going into school maybe hungry. They might go into school saying, you know, without the right equipment. And if you add on top that, if they're actually become physically homeless and they're in a shelter or a hub, then there is that secrecy then that has to come with it. You know, you can't say, well, I'm living up the road in my granny's house. You're saying, I don't, you know, they don't talk about their address. They don't talk about where they are. And then they may have journeys of travel and stuff that make it much more difficult to be present in school. So school doesn't become the sanctuary that it was before. They might go in hungry. They might go in having traveled on two buses for an hour and a half in a Dublin setting. Teachers might be given out to them because they haven't got stuff done. They then have to go home and they've got their lack of privacy to do the homework that they need to do. So there's constant irritations is the nicest way to put it, but there's constant traumatic events happening for them that they have to deal with. And also the insecurity of, how long is this going to be? You know, am I going to be like this all my life? So even if they're old enough to sort of understand the circumstances and the economic circumstances, that uncertainty, because uncertainty is what causes anxiety. Uncertainty creates stress. And if you live with uncertainty for long enough, then you become hyper-vigilant about the world. And you don't trust yourself to deal with the world. So you're always trying to preempt problems. And that leads to a type of insecure, anxious individual or an angry individual. And it can come out in all sorts of ways. So again, even 6 months in that sort of circumstance can change the way a child deals with the world and the way they feel about themselves. So yeah, we're building up enormous trauma in those children.
I think you've set that out and explained it very well. I was actually didn't want you to stop there in terms of explaining that, because I think it is so important that we do, you know, understand. And you know, it's a lot more talk about trauma, which is great in terms of really taking on board what it means to be, you know, traumatized, and the idea of trauma-informed services and responses and how the state responds. Because, you know, there are so many different, you know, ways people are traumatized, and, you know, in terms of sexual abuse, in terms of, you know, poverty, in terms of, you know, personal bereavement. And we, you know, the stress is that, and, you know, we need to see that, you know, we need to respond and support. And I think that there's a real need to understand this impact, because that's kind of where, in many ways, I'm trying to go into, because you're trying to go, like, how the hell do we not, as a society, just, you know, say, stop. Everything stop. We need to stop everything until we ensure everybody, you know, every child has a home as a basic thing, you know, and how do we somehow accept that? And I think part of it is, to a certain extent, is this idea of normalizing. You know, we've normalized poverty levels, we normalize homelessness, we normalize waiting lists, which you're talking about, all the issues that you talk about, to a certain extent are normalized in society. So how do we change our society to not accept these things, Niall, and to demand actually, you know, that we cannot have a society like this and we need to do it differently?
It's a great question. You know, I think many of the big changes have come from political movements or for pushing public outcry in certain ways. I think, again, we need to get to a situation in which the ordinary voices on the street, the people who see this and who understand this and who recognize and know people in that circumstances, is louder than the billionaires and the people who are in bringing money to the system. And we need to find, and I think that's why I think the concept of a referendum for housing needs to be put to the people, because I think people are genuine. They want fairness and justice for all their neighbors. You know, there is still an element of people who follow the sort of Maggie Thatcherite, if I can get it for myself, you can get it for yourself, and I shouldn't be helping you up. But I think the majority of people are still in a situation where, you know, if I can help my neighbor, I will. And you can see that the pandemic has brought that back enormously. Communities are much more important to people. People are moving back from Dublin to their old communities to do remote working. And I think that sense of community will rise up if we're given a chance to vote on the concept of, is it fair and is it right that every child and every individual should have a home? And we're not saying where everybody's going to get a palace. We're saying they have the right to be in a safe, secure, loving environment that they know they can retain. And the fear of eviction is limited. I mean, there'll always be evictions occasionally at times, but it's much more limited. It's much more certain as to when those situations happen, and you have a clarity about it. I think the communities and the people of Ireland will rise up and take that challenge and say, yes, that's something we need to build into our constitution. I can't see, again, they're using the same argument. The constitutional argument was used for Grafton Street, where constitutionally we could only have increases in rents. You know, I mean, that's a ludicrous argument. So we need to change the constitution to make those things go away. We need to do that, and we need to get there quickly. So you're right, the normalization, people have got so hung up. And again, it's part of how the system works, is they've got hung up in their own lives and said, you know, I don't have time for this. I don't have the energy to worry about anybody else. I have to keep the roof over my head. But I think if we sell the referendum as children or referendum for housing as a community coming together and saying, let's protect all of our people, because this, you know, and again, I hate to say this, but the old saying was, you're never more than three paychecks away from homelessness. We all could find ourselves sometimes in this circumstance. And our children are finding it difficult to get on the ladder for housing. So if we can create a situation where the right to housing is there, then that does force people to think, how do we get affordable? How do we get the right sizes? How do we get the right collective of housing? What do they look like? Where are they built? Who owns them? You know, there's so many, you've consistently run conferences that show there's so many different answers to make it available. For the same price, we can get far better quality community built than we could for simple houses and boxes.
Yeah.
So I think once we put that argument to the people, I think that might be one way of moving away from the normalization of this bad stuff has nothing to do with me.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And I really feel that, and I hope we are reaching that point where we're going to see that referendum taking place as soon as COVID permits, because it is vital. I think that happens as soon as possible.
Yeah. And I think, as I said, it's the way it's framed, and there will be strong counter arguments from people who say that this is, you know, this is giving people something for nothing, and it's not. You know, I mean, I think the last time I was on here, I talked to you about my dad in the 1960s was part of a cooperative in Donegal that built a whole housing estate.
Yeah.
They all put in a certain amount of time. They put 40 houses together. They're still standing. They're going well. They've been passed on. It's not impossible to do, and we've been doing that for decades, and it's part of what builds the community. If you can build your own housing estate with the help of the state at a reasonable price, then you own that. You're part of that community, and you want to be there, and you're making a commitment. And we can do that more and more all around the country, and especially if government can hand over some of the land and allow people to do it in a you know, you've, there's many organizations that can help you do that.
Yeah.
That really can change the future.
No, it absolutely could. And I think it's really a key way that in terms of moving forward for children, because when you think about it, you know, children having that home, it's the foundation of everything. It's the foundation of their lives. It's the foundation of stability and community, as you say, as well. And that's, you know, what we need to create. And for you, just looking forward, what would, you know, the big changes you would like to see, you know, in terms of the coming years that you're working on, and maybe thinking post-pandemic, you were talking about, maybe just to finish, you know, what do you see is, yeah, what's your vision for an Ireland that values children?
Well, listen, what I would love, I'd love to see an end to homelessness for children. You know, again, this is an opportunity. I see this as an opportunity for the government. If they look at it properly, you know, we're in debt for, I don't know, 25, 30 billion. Would another 5 billion sort out homelessness? And would that really matter in 40 years' time that we borrowed 35? I don't know what the amount would be, but I think there's an opportunity to change the way our society lives and the way our communities interact with each other if you take that sort of staged change. Not just let's produce more social housing, let's make a strong commitment across all the parties to try and end homelessness within the next 5-10 years, and we make serious inroads into that, because I think that, as I said, that would change society, because those children then become more secure, they become more outgoing, their education becomes much more valuable to them, and they create much more opportunities. Similarly, their parents are able to contribute in a way that they haven't been able to contribute before. And in line with that, then, I'd also be looking at sort of child poverty being done away with as best we can. You know, we need to find a way to create, the ESRI said that there could be 13% of our children in child poverty next year, with 20% at risk of child poverty. We need to make sure that doesn't have 20% of our children at risk of child poverty in the third or fourth richest country in Europe. I mean, that's absolutely, it can't be allowed. It cannot be allowed. So we need to move in that direction. And perhaps one of the things they need to look at is you know, do we create a basic floor of income for all families so that we know they are, they've got, if we get the right to housing in place and people aren't homeless, then you also know they can afford their meals, they can afford their heating, they can afford their clothing, and they can afford their education. If that happens, then everybody starts to blossom and you take away a lot of that anxiety, uncertainty that families are living in, which creates much better opportunities for the children to live to their full potential. It doesn't solve everything. There'll always be issues around it. But I think if we start moving in that direction and show that as a result of the pandemic, we have reimagined our society, then for me, that would be a hugely powerful change. And Ireland will definitely then become one of the best places for children to live over the next 10 years. And it would be a fantastic legacy for anybody who's involved in state agencies to think that way and to achieve that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely what we need to do as a society. And there's no reason why we can't, as you say, in one of the wealthiest countries in the world today. And it is about, you know, putting our children first, creating that, as you say, that, you know, a society that values, that protects, that nurtures. And we should do it. We absolutely should do it. We can do it. And Niall, listen, best of luck for the remainder of your term. And I look forward to working with you on these issues and achieving what you've set out there, which I really think is a fantastic vision. So thank you for all the work you do.
Thank you very much, Roy. It's been a delight to be on, and good luck with all your work too. Keep fighting the good fight.
We will do. And listen, Niall, in terms of if people are interested or want to or raise issues with the office, how do they get in touch with you?
The easiest way is the website is just oco.ie. And also if they want to phone us, it's a free phone number. It's 1800 20 20 40.
Great. Thanks a million, Niall Muldoon, Ombudsman for Children. Thank you so much for joining me on Reboot Republic today. And a reminder to our listeners, please, we put out the appeal to you, become a patron of Reboot Republic. Go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We rely on you to keep the production going. We also really value your support, those who are patrons. We thank you for supporting us. you can sign up for whatever you want each month, and continue to keep this show on the road and support the production of these podcasts, which do cost to produce, and we rely on you to keep the show on the road. Our listenership is expanding hugely, and there's great engagement, but of course all these podcast costs to produce, they take time, and we have no independent we've no advertising, no sponsorship, we're completely independent. So if you can, please support us, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you all soon.